It's the TEH Podcast, episode number 227, with Leo Notenboom of AskLeo.com and Gary Rosenzweig of MacMost.com. This week, Friend, Azure, and Google News. What's wrong with search?
Good afternoon, Gary. How's life in Denver?
Good. How are you doing?
Doing okay. Just got back from taking the dogs for a walk. It's one of those little responsibilities in life.
Yes.
My wife and I went for a walk, took the dogs with us. And of course, I am the designated bag man. Which I suspect you understand right away.
Oh, yeah. Mm-hmm.
So fortunately, we're looking at some pretty hot weather the rest of this week. So we're taking advantage of it being somewhat tolerable today.
Yeah, I have to. My dog walking needs to be scheduled much more in the summer because, I mean, like right now it is 94. That's actually, this is actually one of the cooler afternoons when we're recording this. It's been up to 100. So a dog walk now would not be good. So early in the morning.
Right.
And not as late as possible, but not after dark, because after dark is when the what we call the thunder monster comes out, which we think is in our dog's brain is what he thinks is happening with those rumbling sounds caused by thunderstorms. And he associates them with night.
Right.
And if it's half an hour before sunset, great, let's go. If it's like at sunset, no, I don't want to go anywhere except curled up on the sofa, maybe preferably with a blanket over me.
So
we have to schedule very carefully during the summer.
I can believe it. So anyway, I've got a couple of interesting follow-ups from some of the topics we've been talking over the past couple of weeks. One of them was that little friend device.
Yeah.
I think you brought that up last week. It's basically something you talk to and then it texts you back, which is an interesting interface model, but you know, what the heck? What I discovered, what I ran across was this article that the company behind Friend, they spent $1.8 million to get the domain friend.com.
And that's a good domain.
It's a fine domain, but the problem is that was like 80% of their capital. I mean, they had like $2.4 or $2.3 million worth of capital to start with, and they spent most of it on a domain name. I'm not convinced that that was a wise decision.
Oh.
But, well, sure. I mean, you know,
I get it.
I do get the desirability, but let's face it. We have a lot of companies now that are basing off of things like .ai or .shop is one that I ran into the other day, or any number of different top level domains that are becoming much more mainstream than they used to be.
Well,
For $1.8 million, I might very well opt to go with a non-mainstream, a non.com domain.
Here's what I'm thinking. Okay. I read it. I am not a venture capitalist or anybody even close, but I've read so many books about them. I'm thinking it's a good move from an investment standpoint. If $1.8 million for a domain that should be worth $1.8 million. And then the thing is, if this company does not work out, like most of these, ventures do not,
right.
It's something that's still worth something.
They have an asset.
Yeah, they have an asset that's going to be worth something no matter how badly things go. Like, yeah, because even if like you say, okay, say they do a couple patents or whatever, but then maybe these type of AI gadgets just don't end up doing anything, it could be all worthless. But a domain like friend.com can be something that the investors can look at and say, hey, yeah, we did invest all this money in it, but at the end of the day, if this doesn't work out, we might be able to get like 75% of our investment back just by selling the domain name. So maybe that's the kind of thinking that goes on. It's like when you if you invest in something that involves some real estate, you think, well, even if the business goes belly up, we own some land and then we could sell it and we can get something back. Whereas tech companies tend to be like, if the company fails, there's almost nothing worth selling at the end.
Right.
You have a bunch of software or whatever that's worthless.
Yeah. And those desk chairs just don't go the way they used to.
Exactly. So who knows? I'm just saying, maybe that's the thinking here.
Yeah, I could see it. I'm surprised given the, I guess the part that bothers me the most is not necessarily the 1.8 million for the domain, but the fact that that's like 75% of their investment. I mean, it
Yeah.
seems like they would be wanting to invest more in their technology, but
Maybe there's something hidden there we don't know
we shall
about, or
see. Yep.
yeah.
Yep. To also touch back on a couple of things. Now, this is actually a multi-week topic, but as it turns out, this Monday, in other words, yesterday, I guess, as we're recording this, there was another Azure outage. And I recall you were asking me last week what Azure was, and it's basically a data center with a lot of online services that people can contract, not unlike Amazon's AWS, not unlike Google has some kind of equivalent. Basically, you know, you can take your web services or your online services or your cloud or your whatever, and rather than having your own a data center, your own computers, you basically rent theirs. And it's a fine model. Like I said before, I ask Leo sits at AWS and exactly that model. Apparently, the problem they had yesterday, I think, or no, yesterday was essentially a configuration change to something I think associated with their networking. Which, you know, okay, I get that. I've made those configuration changes and had things go sideways. And, you know, they were quick to identify it and undo it, or roll it back, whatever was appropriate. The week before was, as it turns out, a DDoS attack. They were actually down for a while because of some kind of a coordinated DDoS attack against some of the Azure components. That turned out to be pretty fundamental to a lot of sites in Azure itself. And then, of course, we talked before about CrowdStrike / SolarWinds, how it's you know, they pushed a bug fix that actually caused more havoc than was warranted. My take on this is what I find interesting about all of these. You know, there's the two that are Azure, but the CrowdStrike is more just, you know, a bunch of people that happen to use the same software, is how dependent we've all become on other things and common things. For example, when Azure went down, not only was, you know, MSN wasn't available, MSN.com was not available. LinkedIn went down. That's how I stumbled into it, because I was trying to look somebody up on LinkedIn. It was just like, nope. But the number of non-Microsoft businesses that were affected by this, because they are those people that are, you know, using this infrastructure provided by Azure. The same things happened in the past with AWS. They've actually got a pretty good track record, but there certainly have been instances where, you know, AWS, it almost always comes back to a networking problem, you know, has a problem, and all of a sudden, a bunch of services that we all rely on are suddenly offline. And it becomes quite surprising how that exposes just how many services end up being dependent on what I would simply refer to as a shared point of failure. You know, if we've always talked about, you know, single points of failures in your business, you'd like to have some redundancy. You know, if this breaks, then you can always use that. The internet is wonderful for that. I mean, I think you mentioned it last week, and getting data from point A to point B. You know, if this route doesn't work, well, we just send it this other route. But that doesn't mean that there are still points of failure, and a lot of businesses are sharing those points of failures without necessarily realizing it. I just find it interesting how this has all happened. I know why it's happened, right? I mean, a lot of these businesses, they've decided that they don't want to have a data center of their own. They don't want to have to manage computers. They don't want to have to manage networks. They want to let businesses who are focused on that do it for them. And presumably in the long run, they've done the cost benefit analysis and decided that that's the way to go. I believe Dropbox went both ways. Dropbox, I think, used to be on AWS. And then they decided that it would be they'd be better off with their own data center. I think it's been a few years. But for the most part, you know, a lot of companies that have a lot of investment in what they call iron, basically computers, hardware, etc. They often take a look at these third parties and say, you know what, it sure would be great if we had somebody else to manage all that for us.
Oh, sure.
And that's fine. It makes a whole lot of sense until, you know, somebody else trips on something.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. I did not, once again, I didn't notice any outage or anything like that.
Interesting.
Yeah. But I do, you know, from time to time, things do happen, like a website won't load or whatever. There's too many points of failure. There's like my local ISP,
yep.
Right? There's just maybe that website is down. There's maybe my browser. There's all sorts of things that could go wrong. And it's, I don't know, it's like that, the original, you know, outage from 2-3 weeks ago. I may have actually, in retrospect, have felt that more than I thought.
Huh.
I just assumed it was just normal stuff. Like, yeah, this website's not loading.
I have the same thing. I always assume that it's my network. I always assume, because my network is, you know, it's not a simple one. So I figured, you know, okay, fine, I screwed something up. Or the ISP has been relatively solid, but certainly in the past, there have been issues. But with that in mind, one of the very first things I did when I couldn't get to LinkedIn is I went to Down for Everyone or Just Me.
Oh, yeah. It's hit or miss. I mean,
it told me there was a great big long list of sites that were down and how long they had been down. And I found that very useful because then I knew I can stop worrying about that.
Yes.
Go do something else for a while because people will fix it.
You get from that end of it, you do get that. It's funny because I think a lot of people don't know, for instance, that websites do things like they have a lot of analytics, right? Yeah. So you've got something on the page or, you know, on the server that is keeping track of statistics, which are very important. You know, set aside the whole like, oh, you're tracking people, whatever. It's useful for, say, a site that has content to know which content is the most popular, for instance. Yeah. Things like that. The thing is that sometimes, you know, when those systems are working, you don't notice them. But it could be something as simple as one of these outages to something Azure or something else. Even if that system is down, but if the security protecting that system is down or something, then suddenly the web page goes to load and an element that took a microsecond to load before.
Right.
Now suddenly takes 5 seconds to load, or maybe not 5 seconds to load, but 5 seconds before it gives up.
Right.
And then everything seems slow. And it's like, well, the site's got nothing to do with the outage. Nothing they do has got anything to do with the outage, but it could be like analytics or some piece of content loaded off of a content delivery network or something like that that could get slowed down. And it does affect you. But it's such a way that it's really hard to trace, to ever figure out what is causing the problem and whether or not, you know, the thing in the news is the thing that is making your streaming video on your TV a little clunky today.
Right.
Yeah.
So anyway, I just thought that was interesting. Like I said, we've got a bunch of businesses that are all sharing common points of failure. Hopefully lessons will be learned and more safety nets will be
put more in. Robustness, maybe. Yeah.
Yeah.
Yeah. And that takes us to our, I guess we have a big story for this week.
I guess
a lot
so,
of times we do. Yeah. But it's not AI. it's your story. I'll let you introduce it.
Well, no, it's our story because we're both on this.
Yeah. We're both. We.
So the quote here is simply from, a local news story. A judge ruled on Monday that Google is a monopoly when it comes to the search feature. Mm-hmm. And the reason I copied this particular phrasing is because it really did narrow it down much further than I thought it would. They violated antitrust law by paying other companies to make its search engine the default on smartphone web browsers. Mm-hmm. So, for example, Apple, right?
Yeah.
They're paying Apple a not insubstantial amount of money to make Google's search the default search for Apple. Now, what I thought was interesting is that Nadella, our Microsoft CEO, in his comments, he said that he dismissed as bogus Google's argument that it's easy for users to change their search default. I don't know if it is or not, but what I find horribly ironic and almost to the point of frustrating is that Microsoft has been so guilty of exactly the same kind of behavior in Windows 11. They make it very difficult to avoid their browser everywhere. They make it very difficult to avoid the Bing search engine. So I just found that very, you know, like I said, ironic that he would bring that point up when he's just as guilty of the same same tactic. How easy is it to change your search engine on an iPhone?
It's just a matter of going to settings, and then you go to the appropriate spot, I think, in Safari, and you just, it's just a choice. And there's actually, it's not a open system where you could just, you know, pick your search engine and, you know, you type in a URL or whatever. It is there are five of them, I think, or is it six now? So yeah, if you go into settings, and then you have to go to the apps. So each app kind of has its own set of settings. And then you go into Safari, and then you look for search engine, I believe. Then it's Google, of course, the default, as is a big deal because of this. But you have Bing, you've got DuckDuckGo, you've got Ecosia, and Yahoo as another one. And I think that's it. You can't choose like anyone that you want. You have to choose one of those. Of course, there's nothing to prevent you from still going to a web page that's right. another search engine.
Yep.
But as far as like just typing a search term in the address bar, it has to be one of these that, you know, it's kind of hooked into. I don't know. I mean, you would think, okay, the reasoning is because there is some coding that has to be done. You can't just say, I want to choose this search engine. It's got to know what the URL is and how to build that so you can do a search from the address bar. But it's not that hard.
Like, it's not that hard if I'm not
usually mistaken. Question mark S equals and then, you know, a URL escape search but string.
Even for those sites that don't do it that way, if I'm not mistaken, there's an open standard where you can drop something in the root of your website that says, here's how to search me.
Yeah. So I don't know, you know, how, you know, I know people have said that, you know, you can't just choose anyone. You have to choose from the list of five. But it is fairly easy on a Mac. It's very easy to do. You just in Safari, you go to the settings for Safari. It's the first set of settings is general. And the first thing at the top is search engine. And you can pick one of those. And you can also, a new feature is you can switch it up for private browsing. So when you're doing private, or as Chrome users know it, incognito mode, you can actually choose a different default search engine than you can for your regular mode. That's kind of new. It's interesting because, of course, Apple pays, Google pays Apple to be the default search engine across its platforms.
Right.
Mainly the iPhone is what Google really wants to pay for there. Yeah. And it's, $10 billion a year?
It's a large number.
and there's absolutely nothing to prevent you from just, you know, first thing you do when you get a Mac or an iPhone or iPad from just changing it. And then you're done. You know, Google won't bother you anymore. So it's not like it's going to switch back after a period of time, or in some cases, Google will be used or whatever. It just it's just a switch and you're away. But of course, most people won't switch. A lot of people don't realize that they can switch or know that there's a difference or know what these other search engines even are. Right. A lot of that going on. So I guess it's worth that the price of that just for the Apple market is worth $10 billion, according to the market price, which is just a, you know, whatever Google's willing to pay to do it. I think it's interesting, you know, what is Apple going to do now? Like, because clearly that's definitely a big part of what's been ruled as monopolistic here.
Right.
So Google needs to stop paying for it, and Apple needs to stop taking their money. It's a lot of money, even for Apple.
Yes.
You know, one of the three biggest companies in the world. It's a lot of money to just say, okay. But if they're forced to now, you know, not do it. Like, what does Apple do? I mean, one option is they don't change a thing. They just stop taking the money and they still make Google the default search engine based on the fact that Google may be the best search engine, even in this court case or whatever. It's mentioned several times that Google is the best search engine. So Apple might just go and say, well, we'll turn it over to a team that's going to decide on the best search engine. That'll be the one that's the default. And that team comes back and says, it's Google. And then Google gets for free what they've been paying for. Someone else, I saw someone mention, it's like it could be a prompt when you, the first time that you do a search or the first time you launch the browser on a new machine, it may just have to say, which of these five search engines do you want to use?
Right.
And you choose it once and you're done. Apparently that is done already in the EU on the iPhone, I think. So it's not like Apple doesn't have that code lying around and, you know, already have thought of this. So they could do that. I don't know if they would. Obviously choosing another search engine, so if they choose Bing, or if they choose DuckDuckGo or something, then, you know, is that any better? Than choosing any other one as a default? Do they randomly assign it? Maybe one out of five chance? I don't know. The other thing is that it's been said for a long time now that the reason Apple doesn't have a search engine is the real reason why Google pays this $10 billion, right? Google pays the $10 billion so they can be the default search engine. But also by doing so,
yeah,
they're basically saying, hey, so not only do you not have to spend the money on creating your own search engine, Apple, but if you did, you would actually be losing this $10 billion because you wouldn't get the opportunity to collect it. Right. And so Apple kind of has like a thing, whereas instead of saying, hey, if we don't spend the money on our own search engine, then we don't lose any money. Now it's like, we don't spend the money, then we don't lose $10 billion. It's like a negative $10 billion weight on not creating their own search engine. If Apple were to create their own search engine, because this $10 billion goes away, then what happens from the monopoly standpoint? Because then now there's a default search engine that you're locked into. It's a monopolistic thing. It's like, is that going to violate something? And is Apple going to get sued for creating its own search engine because Google got sued for paying to be the search engine? It's kind of a weird thing. And if Apple can't make their search engine the default, why would they spend money, you know, developing it?
Right. So it's funny because one of the things I heard, because I think everybody's assumption is, well, you know, if Apple can't pay Google,
yeah,
then would they go to somebody else, like say Bing, and take the $10 billion from Microsoft? I don't know that it would be $10 billion at that point, but
right.
The interesting story that I heard, though, was that Apple actually was negotiating with Microsoft to make this happen. But the theory, the scuttlebutt, is that they were doing that only to push up the price that they could eventually end up charging Google.
Yeah.
It seems like that if Google can't provide this service or can't do it this way, it might be advantageous for Apple to just pick another one. The problem, people are lazy. And this is a $10 billion bet on people being lazy, right? They don't want to figure out search engines. They don't want to research which one is better. They don't want to do anything. Sure. They just want to search. For example, so if like you said, they presented a pop-up of, you know, here are the five search engines you can choose from the very first time you try to search. Everybody's going to type on Google because that's probably the only one they recognize.
Yeah.
It's a very strange situation. I did want to mention that a couple months ago, I posted an article. It's actually gotten a fair amount of traffic on YouTube. Why I stopped using Google search.
Mm-hmm.
I'm not using Google search these days, except if I have a Google search specific issue that I'm trying to track down. Two reasons. One is, you know, the plethora of ads. Ad blockers only get you so far in the search results. There's still all sorts of other stuff. But the other one, and this is something that I have been hearing more and more from various corners, is that the quality of Google's search results is on the decline. Mm-hmm. It's a complicated situation for reasons that you and I can get into here in a minute. But the bottom line is that I have been, I don't know, for the longest time, periodically, I'll go over to Bing and see if I get anything useful. Nope, back to Google. Mm. I'll go over to DuckDuckGo and see if it answers my question. Nope, back to Google. Lately, though, I've been running that experiment, and I haven't had to go back to Google.
Yeah.
I've been using Bing a little bit. I've been using actually a paid search engine called Kaji that, you know, it's cheap, but all of a sudden you've got no ads, good results. I mean, it's like, fine. It's really, really interesting and a pleasant experience as opposed to some of the others. No AI involved and so on. And that, I think, kind of dovetails into the problem that Google is facing, that the other search engines may not have to face yet. And that is, to put it really bluntly, what you and I have been doing for the past 20 years, especially in the early days of Ask Leo, hell, the first three quarters of Ask Leo, if I wanted my site to be found, if I wanted my answers to get to people, I had to rank well in Google. That implies you do some things, usually referred to as search engine optimization or SEO. The SEO that I do for the longest time, the SEO that I do is, you know, I make sure that, you know, the titles are good and that my answers are answers and it's well written and there's a couple of mechanical things under the hood, but I don't try and game SEO. What's happening right now is a lot of websites are in the process of gaming SEO, specifically with AI generated content. And it's turning into quite the mess. And because Google is 91% of the market share, that's the target. That's where all of these websites are targeting. They're using, you know, they're basically upping their SEO game to try and get Google to pay better attention to them. It's tough because Google needs to have a way to identify what the quote unquote best result is for any given search. It's to their advantage to keep that a secret, what those rules really are, but that doesn't prevent people from slowly reverse engineering it and then doing everything in their power to follow those rules, whether or not they deserve the rating or not.
Mm-hmm.
It's been tough. And like you said, we've basically been, I don't want to say hamstrung, but dependent on Google for a very long time.
Yeah, definitely. I mean, it's, you know, using the term monopoly for Google, I mean, there's so many different angles that there's a monopoly. And I, you know, what's being talked about here is a monopoly as a search engine with the advertising revenue and all of that. It's very consumer facing. But from the website content creator side of things, we've really been seeing Google as a monopoly for decades.
Yes.
And it's just a lot harder to get attention, you know, when you're just, it's just the small group of website content creators. But it is, yeah, if you start a website and it doesn't show up in search results, it's a dead website. I mean, you're not going to make any money off of it.
You might not exist. Yep.
Yeah. If you start a website and you happen to hit the jackpot and Google decides to put you right at the top of a very lucrative search term search result, you could have overnight success. And then you could have that taken away from you like 3 weeks later when it suddenly doesn't appear there anymore.
I think we've both experienced this at various times.
Yeah. And it's and there's nobody to talk to, nobody to complain to, nothing. How you get there isn't clear. It's a lot of just stuff that's hidden in algorithms. There's a whole industry, the search engine optimization industry, which I gather isn't quite as big today as it used to be, but it used to be huge, just trying to guarantee you results of, you know, if you did this or that, or you followed this instruction or here's a new secret or whatever. And it just went on and on for years. And Google would, you know, was either the good guy, the savior of whatever you're doing, or was the bad guy, depending upon what was going on. You could complain about search results, you know, when you make some content and you say, boy, so if somebody searches for what they would be searching for to get to this page, I don't come up in Google, or I come up, you know, way down many pages below the top result. And the stuff at the top is bad. Like it doesn't answer the question or it's not quality. Then it's, you know, Google's seen as being bad. But if you do show up at the top, then it's like, yay, thanks Google for sending all this traffic my way. And it's been going on for a long time. And it would have been nice to not have a search engine that was like completely, you know, dominant over everything else.
Right.
Even just to have a dichotomy, you know, to have like a lot of other industries and things have, to have two search engines that mm-hmm. were battling each other. And then you could be, okay, well now maybe I'm doing well with one and not with the other, or vice versa. That would have been good, I think, not just for the industry and for people making content, but it might've been good for the search engines too, because the problem is that Google wants to show you the best results, but what does best mean? Best means what's best for Google, right?
Yep.
What's going to make them the most money somehow. So when you picture, like, if you search for something on a search engine, let's say it's Google, and you find that answer is the first hit and you click and then you're happy. You go to the site, you get your answer, and you don't go back to Google now because maybe the site is interesting and you're there for the next while. Or you're done for the day because you got your answer. That doesn't help Google. What helps Google more is if you go to it and you get kind of some useful information, but before long, you have to go back to the search page and look at number two or number three or whatever, or maybe look at some of the information that Google gives you. I remember a time, well, we both remember a time when Google always said, hey, we're in the search engine business. Somebody asks a question. Our goal is to get them to your website where you've got the answer, and we won't compete with you. And then Google just turned around and took that away and started putting right. answers for things right on the search page, with the idea being that, you know what, if the person doesn't need to leave the search page to get their answer, that's better for Google. And then you're like, oh, I put tons of work into this answer, and yet now Google is saying, don't bother to actually go to the page where the answer comes from. We'll give it to you on the page itself, whether it's from your site, from Wikipedia, or something that Google just does. Even for stupid things like the games that I make, right? Like there are some, Google has some games. If you search for certain things, Google will say, oh, you want to play a game of solitaire? Oh, you can play it right here on the Google page. No need to go to any of these websites that have a solitaire game.
Right.
And that's definitely kind of monopolistic, but well below the radar of like what we're talking about going on sure. here. And
what I've always
Google
found
being,
kind of frustrating is that yeah. when they started providing answers, the answers were copy pastes from some of the websites they were referencing.
Yeah.
They were verbatim text from some of the answered sites. And you might go through to get more details, but if what they copy pasted was enough, like you said, they had no reason to move on. The next level that they've taken on is now they're using AI
yeah.
to summarize the, I'll call it just the takeaways from the first N sites or however many sites they think are relevant, so that it's a synthesized answer from multiple sources. Is it any good? Don't know, but it does, again, answer the question, and it absolutely reduces people's incentive to go through, to follow through to the various websites that provided the information in the first place.
So I got a question for you.
Okay.
What if this all goes down some big legal rulings, you know, path, and search engines basically become non-viable? Like there are no more search engines. They all go away. Bing, Google, DuckDuckGo, they're gone. Are we at the point? I mean, I think 10 years ago, definitely 20 years ago, it's like the internet would have been made useless without the search engine. I'm not so sure now. I think it would be a lot different of an experience, but I find myself going to a search engine much, you know, much less of the time than in the past. Like I will know where to go. Like if I want to find some information, I'll know, oh, I'm going to search Reddit. I'm going to search Stack Overflow. I'm going to go and go to this site or this blog or something like that. I mean,
there's a an activation problem there.
Yeah.
If people don't know that Reddit exists and it has their answers, how will they ever find out?
Marketing. I mean, you know, that's what it comes down to. It's like, you know, before the internet, there have been centuries of publications, of places to get information. There were libraries, encyclopedias, there were magazines and newspapers and all of that. And you had to know. Do you remember in school, like being given assignments and you'd have to be like, oh, I need to research this at the library. And you go to the library and, you know, you ask the librarian. The librarian's like, oh, on that topic, here's where you go. Here's a reference book or here's the section that has those books there. Look through what's available.
So you had a search engine.
Kind of.
Seriously. But if you're asking the librarian, where do I find this information?
No, that's different
specific
though.
Books and such. It's more, it's not unlike Google or any search engine.
Well, why couldn't you? Yeah, it is unlike it because, I mean, you can go and say, you can go to somebody, a friend, somebody online, whatever, and say, boy, I really have, am having trouble finding information on street photography. Like I want to find some, and somebody could say, oh, I can recommend some good bloggers that talk about that and a couple good sites. And you don't need the search engine for that. You're not searching for a specific thing, but you're like, you go and you narrow down the information. Maybe you end up asking a librarian. Maybe you end up going to the sources you know now and finding out like where that comes from. Or maybe you just basically keep reading your news sources and doing your things. And then one day you stumble upon this site that's like, oh, I've been looking for a site like this. Kind of like we used to with books and magazines and newspapers. Like, I don't know if it's like people don't know about Reddit. Yeah. Okay. So there are some people that might not know about a big major site like Reddit. Mm-hmm. But I would say that one of the things keeping them from knowing about it is the existence of search engines. They don't need to know about it. Just search and stuff will come up. But suddenly, if there were no search engines, then the number of people that knew that Reddit existed or sites that have to do with their industry, say, existed, that would go way up to near 100% because you wouldn't have an alternative. Like if I search for technical information and there's like three main sites that have technical information on them, I may not even know those sites exist because I keep finding the results in search engine results. They take me to those sites, but I don't even bother to look at the URL. Or the logo at the top. I just find my answer and go away. But without a search engine, I'm forced to kind of like learn that though there are three sites and that I need to go to these three sites if I want to find an answer to that type of question, because the search engine isn't my crutch for me to lean on anymore.
I kind of sort of see what you're saying. I just don't see it as being practical. I mean, there is a bucket load of information available on the internet.
Yeah.
And people know this. And they're going to want to find the information that they know exists.
Yeah.
They just don't know where it is.
Well, what if so you went to
even if the major search engines all went away overnight, there's going to be some entrepreneur in a corner that says, you know what? I know you're looking for stuff. I can provide you a service that will find things for you.
Yeah, but maybe in a niche way, like maybe
not. No. That this entrepreneur is going to basically reinvent the search engine because
it's illegal. It's illegal now to have a search engine.
Well, whatever the rules are that make that illegal, just skirt up to those rules. That's what he's going to do.
Well, no, yeah, but you forget the one thing about search engines is they're expensive to run. So that's why you need the money to run them. So it's not that the search engines become illegal, like there's a law against search engines. It's just there's a law against the monopolistic practices. But those practices are what made search engines profitable. So suddenly, you can create your own search engine. It's going to cost you a fortune. And it doesn't make sense for you to do it just out of the goodness of your heart, or you and your 1,000 employees to do it all as a volunteer thing. I mean, I think there could still be search engines that could be very niche. And I still think that you still can find things. Like, for instance, there'll be no problem with being able to search a website. So YouTube, what is that? The second or third biggest search engine. They say it's, but it's not really. You're searching YouTube. But if you're into street photography, as was my example, you go now to YouTube, and you search for street photography there, and you see some videos there, and some of those videos may talk about, well, they already do. Some of those videos already do talk about, I've got this blog. I'm a blogger about street photography. If you want to see some of my photos, my recommendations, go to my website. In the meantime, let's take a look at this camera. So you discover it because you went to YouTube, or you discover it because your friend who's also into street photography is somebody you follow on social media, and they're always posting the blog post from that site. Or maybe social media is another answer there. You ask people, not the librarian, but you go to your social network and you say, I'm getting into crochet. What are some good crochet websites? And somebody in your social circle says, I know of one, here it is. Or here's like three of them. Or here's a blogger that talks about crochet websites. So I think it could work now. I don't think it could have worked years ago. I think now we're at a point where search engines are something we all lean on. I don't think they're necessary anymore.
It's interesting. I mean, like I said, it still feels impractical, but I certainly understand the argument. One of the things that factors into this is that for a lot of people, the search engine is the internet.
Yeah.
What was it? I don't know if it's still true, but years ago, the number one searched term on Google was Hotmail, because people used it as a way to get to hotmail.com. And I'm sure the same is still true. It's just a different player at the top of that list now. So I don't know. Like I said, it's certainly something like that isn't going to happen in a hurry. I think that the major players just have too much invested in this to let it go without a fight. Yeah. But it would be interesting to see. Do you actually know of any niche search engines?
I would just say it's the ones that are on the sites themselves, like searching Reddit, for instance, which you could search, for a niche inside of Reddit, which I do all the time. I think that there really can't exist good niche search engines as long as there are the big dominant ones. It's just not going to be enough of a call for it. Mm-hmm. But it could be an interesting, it could be something that, is being prevented, because why would you go to a niche one? We could go to Google and just have a good search term. I don't know. I have on my to-do list a video about something about bad search engine habits, or don't do this when you're searching. Like the obvious one, of course, is don't search for the name of a website. Don't go to Google and then search Amazon and then click on the first link to get to the Amazon website.
Well, there's that. And also my number one, if I had to have a number one, don't do this, is don't search for customer support. For anybody, if you're like, say you've got a problem with your Delta Airlines ticket, do not search Google for Delta customer service.
The results will be crap.
Guaranteed, the results will be crap.
That's your list. that's a good one. Yeah, I mean, the ones that, and there are other things too about, like, I mean, I think we're getting to the point now, whereas if what you want is a web page or website, or you want something to read. Mm-hmm. Search engine, is a good way to go. If you want an answer to something, to a question you've got, it's specific, not a long answer, not a explain how this works, but a give me the answer to this question. AI is really getting up there in terms of like, just go to AI or that answer to the thing that you want.
I struggle with that. I struggle with that because
I mean,
this
that's
is
what Google is
just,
putting on the search
I
results
understand, which
anyway.
is one of the reasons I really don't like it. The struggle I have, the thing that I've often said about what I do is that I answer people's questions and then sneak in some education.
That's true, yeah.
And I think that that is serving the people better than just giving them the answer. Because this way, with a little bit of education, they're less likely to need another answer. They're more likely to be able to solve their own problems. And if you're just giving people the answer, you're missing that opportunity, and I don't think it serves the people as well.
Maybe. I think it depends on the question. Maybe, if you just want to know what's the three-letter code for the International Airport in Seattle, that's what I want to know. Then it's like, just give me that three-letter code. I could ask Google, I'll get the answer. But I could also ask AI. If I want to know about, like what are some good alternatives to flying in and out of the Seattle airport, then I may want to do a web search. Because I'll get more than just a list of like, one or two airports. I might get information about like why it's not a good idea to fly out of this airport, because the fees are higher, so your flight's going to be higher, or the traffic on this high, you get more information. But so it really depends. If you want a real, just an answer, just a quick answer to something, I think search engines sometimes, you're wasting your time doing a search engine. Because a lot of that is because of the SEO and stuff. Because you're saying what you said is true for you and me.
Yes.
We're giving like lots of stuff, and I get complaints all the time when somebody like I have a video that continues to get good traffic. How to prevent spam? How to prevent you from getting spam email?
Right.
And the answer I give is basically I could just sum it up into get a good ISP. Good ISP is going to filter on the server. A bad ISP is not going to care and just going to send everything to you. And that's why you get a lot of spam. But the thing is, I take 8 minutes to say that. Why do I take 8 minutes to say that? Because if I just tell you that at the beginning, nobody's going to care. Like they'll be like, whatever, I want a good answer, right? I spend 7 minutes explaining why spam is hard to filter, why you're getting a lot of spam, why this is your best shot. And why you're never going to completely eliminate spam and all of that. And I still get people complaining. Just tell us the answer. Why did you get to the point? Why did you take 8 minutes to give us the answer and all that? And it's like, because you don't understand, people are not going to buy my answer unless I explain. And the problem with that is that the whole SEO business, there are so many posts out there, so many articles that will actually just waste your time. You look up something like, why does this happen? Why is this thing true or whatever? And the first 2 pages worth of text are just rehashing because the answer is 2 sentences. But if they put the answer at the top in 2 sentences, that's not as good of an article, or they're not going to make as much money as if they rehash, restate the problem, restate it in several different ways. Explain some history that you're not interested in, and eventually get to the answer at the bottom, which sometimes is nope, you can't do that, or something like that. So it depends. Good content deserves you to pay attention to what's there, but there's plenty of bad content that just does not deserve it. So I don't know. That's a bit of a tangent there, but it's another. This whole episode is like, what's wrong with search?
It's funny because one of the statements that Google made long ago when we were in, oh, I don't know, I suspect it was after one of the algorithm changes where like our traffic dropped by 50% or something like that, which has happened multiple times, although there have been other updates where all of a sudden our traffic goes up by 20%, but it always seems to be a downward trend. Is that, we keep asking, well, what do we do to our content so that you'll show it properly? And the answer was always write good content. Yeah. Write answers that people want to read. You know, basically serve your audience. And unfortunately, the kinds of things that Google is doing right now, well, for one thing, serving your audience is necessarily the same for everybody. Like mm-hmm. I said, some people, like you said, some people just want answers. Some people want answers, but they also need explanations. Serving your audience is, you know, different for different people. So a lot of us went out and wrote content that serves our audience, but now today we're finding that, well, you know, that doesn't really help you rank in Google. It doesn't help your visibility. Mm-hmm. And in a lot of cases, people's search for an answer is a frustrating process of running down through a lot of these websites that you just described. It's funny, I was smiling as you were saying that because I ran into one of those just, oh gosh, yesterday, I think. I forget what I was searching for, but it was classic. It was exactly as you described, page after page after page mm-hmm. of background. And then finally, one sentence answer. It's like, well, this article wasn't written for me. It was written for search mm-hmm. engines and yeah. traffic and advertising. So yeah. It's tough. It is a tough situation. One of the things, though, that I have been doing with Ask Leo, and you're way ahead of me on this, is I am definitely paying more attention to YouTube. Mm-hmm. Because I think it's funny. You made a very interesting statement, and I hadn't thought about it that way. YouTube is the second largest search engine on the planet. Mm-hmm. And that's because in a very real sense, it is. People will have something that they're searching for, and they might take it to Google to search the entire internet, or they'll do the same search on YouTube, and they're just searching for information. So YouTube is basically a site search that is sufficiently massive as to be a very good alternative for a search engine that's just not searching the entire web. So anyway, I've been focusing a lot more of my efforts on YouTube just because... I think that while there are problems with YouTube, and I certainly expect that in the years to come, those problems may end up on other people's radars. For now, it's both a reasonable search engine for people to use, and it's a reasonable place to be.
Yeah, definitely. And or kind of wherever you like to be. I mean, if Instagram's your thing, I know not as many people search on places like Instagram and TikTok, but you can search.
People, I keep hearing about people searching for answers on TikTok, and I struggle with that. Not because I don't believe it. Mm-hmm. It's because I don't really see TikTok as being an answer providing medium. But that may just be because the algorithm's not showing me those
yeah.
TikToks, right?
Well, I think the algorithm of looking through your For You page, it's not going to favor videos that answer questions.
Right.
Doesn't mean those videos aren't there. But right. I think the same is kind of true for YouTube. Because if you go to YouTube to get an answer to a question, which I think people are much more likely to do.
Yes.
But then you just, when you're done that, you just see a video off to the side, you know, list videos that kind of catches your attention. And then you decide to start suddenly using YouTube for the next while just to take a break. Right. And you watch a video on this subject, that subject. It becomes a lot more like TikTok and Instagram Reels. Like, it's not giving you things that are like, here's an answer to something. It's just showing you something entertaining or some sort of neat subject. Like, you know, I'm constantly recommended videos that have to do with music history, for instance. And those can be hard for me to resist, which is why YouTube recognizes that it should, and it'll be like, oh, there's a history behind this song, or like, what's the, you know, which Beatle played the bass track on this particular song. It's something that I'm like, oh, give me a break. And then 5 minutes later, I'm like, all right, I'm going to click on it because I want to know. And then I watch it, and then it suggests another video. And it's like, okay, these are different types of videos than what I see when I go to YouTube and say, show me how to replace the battery in this little solar gadget I've got, or whatever it is.
Right.
So I think, you know, it's there.
YouTube's algorithm frustrates me in the sense that I think it's look back window for deciding what you're interested in is too small.
Yeah.
By that, I mean, it's not uncommon for me to look for a video for some background music or something. So I'll have a 8 hours worth of melodic trance running around in the background of while I'm working. And all of a sudden, my default YouTube page is full of, trance, lo-fi, ambient music, all that kind of stuff. Just because I looked at one video, or because I spent a fair amount of time, because I'm sure that's their big measure, I spent a fair amount of time listening to that one video. Then I will, I think I mentioned, what was it? One of my Ain't It Cools last week was railway videos. I discovered another channel for railway videos that focuses on the Netherlands. So I've been watching a lot of that lately. And all of a sudden, the page is full of railway videos, to the exclusion of almost everything else that I'm actually interested in. What I've started doing with YouTube, I did this long ago. It's the equivalent of the For You page versus the following page on TikTok. If you look at following, you're only going to get TikToks from the creators that you're actually following, that you've literally said follow. Same thing is true on YouTube. I keep wanting you to hit the subscribe button, but the subscribe button doesn't really do anything unless you actually go to your own subscribed page, and then it shows you all of the videos from those creators that you subscribe to. That's where I end up spending most of my time these days. But it's frustrating. I'm interested in a lot more than trance and trains.
Well, yeah, but whatever will get you to keep watching.
That's what it boils down to, I think. You're right.
Cool. Well, we spent this whole episode being grumpy, but let's get even grumpier.
All right.
Yeah.
Hold on. So one of the things I heard several months ago, it made me scratch my head. Apparently, when you are texting, and I assume this applies to any short form messaging, if you actually terminate your statement with a period, that's being interpreted as being passive aggressive.
Mm-hmm.
And I don't get that. I mean, there's a period, a full stop to those in Britain, it's because I ended my thought. I came to the end of a sentence and I hit period. How are people reading in passive aggressiveness? If I wanted to be passive aggressive, you would know it from the words, not the punctuation.
Yeah.
Anyway, that's my, get off my lawn.
Yeah. For me, it's, my thing this week is, somebody asked me a question, YouTube comments, my site, social media, whatever it is. I give them an answer, and that's the, I don't hear anything.
Right.
That, and now if they gave a really clear question and I gave them the right answer and I don't hear anything, it's not so bad. But so often I am wondering, the question is kind of open. It's like, is this your problem? My answer will be something, it sounds like you're describing this. If that's the case, try this. And then I don't hear anything. And it's like, well, now I want to know. It's like, did it help you? Was this the problem? Whatever. And sometimes I'll ask a question in return. And it's kind of like you would never do it in real life, right? You would never run into a doctor's office, a lawyer's office, or like an auto mechanic shop, run in, go to the expert and say, here's my question. And then they respond with an answer and you just turn and run away. You don't do that. So anyway, it's something. Sometimes I wonder if they're seeing the answer at all. And if they're not, I just wasted minutes of my life, maybe looking up, maybe figuring it out an answer. And, which is half the time. I just kind of respond with a question,
it's funny.
To clarify this, because it's like, unless I know you're engaged, unless I know you're really coming back for this, I'm not spending 5 minutes figuring this out for you.
As you can expect, I run into this also all the time.
Yeah.
But because I've been running into this, I have taken to, at least on some of those, questions where you're providing something that might be the answer because you don't really have all of the information. I will often add a line at the bottom. So it's just, let me know. so that there's an open request from me apply with how things turned out.
Yeah.
But yes, it's like I said, all the time.
Well, not everything is bad. What's cool this week?
So, have you heard of the game Exploding Kittens?
Oh, yes, certainly.
From
the
Mr.
oatmeal.
Yep.
Yeah.
That has been turned into a TV show, which I find interesting. I basically, when I saw the very first announcements of it, I was hooked before I even saw it, because the one of the people they hired for a voice is Tom Ellis. Now, I don't know if you ever watched the show Lucifer, but he played Lucifer. He's a very funny guy. He's really good. And he is the voice of Godcat, which, again, is both ironic, having played Lucifer, now he gets to play God. But the good news here is that Exploding Kittens, the show, to the best of my understanding, is not really the game. I did take a look at the game, and it just didn't do it for me. Exploding Kittens, the show, really is 8 episodes of comedy with a storyline and an arc, characters that are interesting, the model of God having been sent down to Earth to basically help a family, but in the form of a cat, is entertaining. So, like I said, Exploding Kittens, it's on Netflix. If you enjoy that kind of thing, if it sounds interesting to you, I can absolutely suggest it, because we had fun watching it.
Cool. Strangely, my recommendation also involves a supreme being character. It's the new TV show Time Bandits. Of course, there was the movie Time Bandits, the Terry Gilliam movie in the 80s. And this is a reimagining of the entire thing, brought to you by that whole kind of New Zealand crew, Taika Waititi and Jermaine Clement, you know, some of the people that, you know, were behind things like Our Flag Means Death and, Flight of the Conchords, What We Do in the Shadows. You know, there's a lot of New Zealand connection in some of these really cool shows. So this is a kind of reimagining of that. It's got the same basic premise, but there's a lot that's different. And of course, having a TV series means they can concentrate on one era per episode of the show. So like, for instance, is it the first or second episode, they go to the Mayan Empire and they can dispense with language barriers because they wear translation hats. And then, of course, there's the whole, I just love the comedy trope of being historical, but having the people in history speak as if they're modern. And the show does that.
Okay.
So the Mayan people you hear them speaking English because the translation hats that the characters are wearing, and they talk just like modern people. So it kind of is a funny juxtaposition of, what you're seeing versus how people are actually talking. Anyway, it has a good promise. I love anything that uses history with comedy and kind of wraps them together. So anyway, fun show.
So two comments. One, have you ever heard of it would be a 1960s Irwin Allen show called The Time Machine?
I mean, I'm familiar with the movie The Time Machine from.
No, this was a series. This was a series.
No, yes. I don't think so.
It's unrelated to the H.G. Wells book. Individual, they develop a time machine. Individuals go out and then they can't get them back. And every week there's a new attempt to get them back that lands them in some other time. So it's has a lot of that flavor to it. It's kind of funny. Have you seen, and to go back to historical comedy, have you seen The Serpent Queen?
No.
You might enjoy that. That's on Star. Okay. Don't know if you got it. But it just finished its second season. And it is, in fact, exactly that. It's a reinterpretation of, the queen. Let's see. I'm trying to think of the exact timing. Yeah, I don't have it. The other one that, again, also would fall into this category is Vikings Valhalla. That is another one that I think is interesting. The second series of that one also starts to diverge off into some very interesting semi-historical stuff with the Pope, Venice, the Holy Roman Empire, people in France, etc. So you might want to have a look at those too.
Okay, cool.
See, self-promotion. So I've included a link up above that I just added for why I've stopped using Google search, because I think that that's interesting with the topic we were talking about. The other one that I selected for this section is why I avoid Windows default folders. It's askleo.com/172543. The default folders in this case I'm talking about are the documents, pictures, videos, downloads, I think there's one other, that desktop, that are by default the folders that are used for those things by Windows, but Windows and its apps make a bunch of assumptions about what should happen with things you put in that folder, and those assumptions are often wrong. So I explain all of that and what I do instead, why I avoid Windows default folders, askleo.com/172543.
Cool. I've got a new version of my Clip Tools clipboard manager for Mac out. So it's version 1.5. It adds a couple of little new features in there, like a snooze feature and a search feature to search through your clips. But mainly it adds a lot more power because there's a lot of tools in the menu that you could do. For instance, you can capitalize all the words, or you can convert numbers to words, you know, the digits to like the spelled out words, right, or things like that. And now my little programmable part of it, Smart Clips is what I call it, incorporates all of those things. So basically I made it so that all the stuff that you could do in the menu, you can now do in Smart Clips, and you can nest them. So if you wanted to actually like copy something to the clipboard and then paste some text with that name that you just copied in there, but capitalize the name properly, you could do that. You can nest all those things together and make a smart clip that basically does your little workflow that you want, and then assign it to a keyboard shortcut, and it becomes really powerful. So anyway, it's a totally free clipboard manager for Mac, and the video I'll point to is the video where I talk about the new features in this version 1.5.
Very cool. When's the Windows version coming out?
Never. Yeah. I don't get asked much for a Windows version. I do get asked for a iPhone version, but of course, you know, the sandboxing kind of prevents almost everything that I'm doing. I mean, first of all, there's no menu bar. But even doing like basic stuff, like I would need to create like a custom keyboard that you would need to use, or you would have to go from whatever app you're using to my app, do the thing you want to do, and then copy it back. It would be like a whole thing. This really is a Mac computer type of app, and it'll probably remain so.
Very cool. Yeah. All righty. Well, I think that pretty much wraps us up for yet another week.
Yep.
As always, thanks for listening, and we see you here again real soon. Take care, everyone. Bye-bye. Yep.
Bye.
The show notes for this week are at thpodcast.com/TEH227. If you have a comment or question for us, be sure to leave it on the show notes page. The TEH podcast is hosted by Leo Notenboom of AskLeo.com and Gary Rosenzweig of MacMost.com, and edited by Connie Delaney. I'm your synthetic announcer, Adam, from 11labs.com. Thanks again for listening, and we'll see you here real soon.